Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door.
Hi, welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. Welcome back.
Today we are, we're talking about the whole of, I don't even really know how to start this, I guess. There's so many things popcorning in my brain. I guess let's start with an update. Yeah.
Sure. That sounds like a plan.
So a couple weeks ago, during, of course, Christmas season, which is no surprise to anybody.
It probably is a surprise to some people, because not everybody, I think, tracks with us about the reality of how holidays and traditions and all of that have been misused by these people.
True. Okay, so we'll get to that. But so a couple weeks ago, I was served with another lawsuit at my home. Sherry Kern, the wife of Cal Kern, who Cal Kern is already suing Lori and I for defamation, which they served that lawsuit, or they tried to serve that lawsuit on my birthday in May. And now at Christmas time, Sherry Kern, his wife, is suing me, also for defamation. Obviously, for so many reasons, we're not going to really talk about the details of that because it doesn't matter. I mean, it's a matter of public record. So, however, what we want to talk about is the significance of that and the idea and the reality that we've been talking so much about family-controlled trafficking, but we need to broaden out that lens and start talking more about organized abuse. Because things like this are a classic playbook move by people who are conducting organized abuse.
Right. So I just want to comment, and we are going to share more about this, but this is not, we're not talking about Kate's experience alone. We're talking about what exists in the research. We are talking about what exists in the literature. And I just think people want to believe that this is some kind of one-off, because then they can either dismiss it as like, well, it can't be true, or they can dismiss it as, oh my gosh, that's terrible for that poor woman. But we probably don't need to worry about that because it's not like happening everywhere. But it is in the research as not uncommon.
Yeah, no, it's not. And, you know, we've been kind of swimming in this for a long time with starting our nonprofit and with Mezzo and all of that. But I don't know that we've really talked too much about it on the podcast, right? We keep referring to it as family-controlled trafficking, which it is. But family-controlled trafficking falls under the larger heading of organized abuse. And we haven't really broadened out that lens, because my experience was family-controlled trafficking. But the trafficking word, that piece of it is really only the exchange of money. It's the monetary part of the organized abuse that occurred. And so that's a really important thing to talk about. But again, we've been swimming in this, we've known this, and we've been talking about it in our trainings, and we've talked about it with Mezzo, but on the podcast, I don't know that we really have. So
we've mentioned it, but I don't think we've really talked in detail about that. The idea that organized abuse is multiple offenders working in concert to abuse more than one child. Organized abuse. And sometimes that involves the exchange of money, and sometimes it does not. And sometimes that involves the production and distribution of child sexual abuse materials. Sometimes it does not. But it does always mean an organized group of people, typically men, sexually abusing children. So the research shows us that when there is an organized abuse network that is abusing children outside of the family, typically it is frankly, based on the research, men abusing boys more often, not that there aren't girls, but often enough in an extra familial organized abuse situation, it's men abusing boys. In the family, when it's intrafamilial organized abuse, it is typically men abusing girls. And the difference being in out of the family abuse, there tends to be more victims, but less serious abuse. And in family abuse, there tends to be fewer victims, but more serious, more long-term abuse that happens, often into adulthood.
So, I guess as we like start into this whole episode, let's talk about the statistics that we've been sharing in our trainings. Because again, what we keep hearing is, like you said, people assume that this is a one-off thing or that this is couldn't possibly be true because it's just my word. And we've heard that over and over again. Do we just take this woman's word for it? Like, no, actually, it's in the statistics.
I know we've said it before, but in what other crime do I have to present to you essentially a video recording of the bad thing that happened in order to get anyone to hear me or see me? If my house is burglarized, law enforcement doesn't come to me prepared to find the holes in my story. Law enforcement comes to help me to find out who took my stuff, who frightened me. That is not true in sexual assault. The basic demeanor of law enforcement, unfortunately, too often, and it is, okay, let me finish that statement. The basic demeanor of law enforcement where there is sexual assault happening is one of prepared to be discrediting of the reporter, right? And that's why the statistics are what they are about what victims of sexual crimes say about their encounters with law enforcement. Predominantly, the statistic is that victims of sexual assault crimes feel worse after their encounters with law enforcement rather than better. So what we have found across multiple studies, right? There's not a lot of research on this topic, unfortunately, but what has been found in the research is this is not an uncommon phenomenon. One particular study that we've been citing in 2016, the Canadian Centre for Child Protection, together with I think the UK and the United States, conducted a survey of adults whose images were found in child sexual abuse materials, what we commonly think of as child pornography. So these are adults who know that their image is out there in CSIM. So they did a survey and they asked, "Tell us about your experience." So some of the statistics that we have heard include.
58% of those victims reported having had more than one person abusing them. 82% reported that parents or extended family members were the primary offenders when there was a multiple offender scenario. 56% reported that the abuse started before the age of four. Before the age of four. 87% reported that the abuse started before the age of 11. 42% of them were abused for more than 10 years, which again, it's
So we typically think about offenders more in either an opportunistic situation where a kid happens to be there. I have this disgusting, twisted way that I do things, and oh, I'm going to do that. And we also think of sex offenders, pedophiles, as being like they're interested in a certain age range. But if a child is being abused for more than 10 years, they are crossing through various stages of development.
53% of those children whose abuse started before the age of four reported being abused continuing into adulthood. So again, in my case, in my scenario, right, people might say, how is it possible that she is still dealing with this and that she was still dealing with this, all the way through into adulthood? Well, that's why. Because 53% of people whose images were found on, in child sexual abuse material are saying, yeah, it started before the age of four and I was abused all the way into my adulthood. So
And
again,
if
it's not uncommon.
no, and if we think about what we've said before about child development, that things prior to the age of four, it's foundational. And we understand that. There's a whole public information campaign about 0 to 3 and how important those years are for building neural pathways and creating connections and all of those things. We should not be surprised when we read this statistic, and I I think we can post the research, right? People read it for yourself, right? No problem. We should not be surprised to find that if your abuse started so young, that it would be very difficult to break free, to be mm-hmm. safe, that these people don't just stop.
No, they don't just stop, obviously. They don't just stop, right? We have a podcast and we have all the things and we have all the support in the world and we're so grateful for that. And shit still keeps happening, right? There is still shit that is going on that we don't really talk about on the podcast as much anymore because we are trying to shift our focus to what do we do for the people that are coming after us, right? What do we do for the victims that are going to have to walk into this space because they have to? What are we doing for the children that are walking into Cornerstone Church on Grand Island every fucking Sunday? You can. What are we doing for that, right? And so we haven't been talking as much about what is still happening to me, what is still happening in my world and in our world. But it has not.
Doesn't just stop.
It doesn't just stop. These people do not just stop. That is classic organized abuse and family controlled trafficking behavior. It's classic. We've talked to so many professionals in the field about this reality. And what they say to us is, in a typical trafficking situation, the trafficker is like, once the victim is out and is safe, they're like, bye. Like, they don't, it's not worth it to them to continue to engage.
Because they're just after the money. And this person is no longer making the money. They can find another. This is disgusting. But they can find another girl who's going to make them money without the hassle of going and dragging back this person.
Exactly.
I'm not saying that it never happens, that the in pimp control trafficking, that they don't go and get whoever it is that they want back into their under their control. Yes, it happens. But at some point, they just like move on.
Yep.
But not in this.
No. Not in this. And again, it's not just me. I have heard repeatedly from other victims. We have seen the research. We have seen the studies that say 53% said they were abused into adulthood, right? You can't really ignore those statistics. You can't ignore the other victims who are saying, yeah, me too. These people do not just stop, and they have not just stopped. Just because we are not acknowledging it doesn't mean it hasn't stopped.
Right. And it's a push-pull for us, right? Maybe we'll cut this, but it's a push-pull for us of, I am so sick of having to talk about these people. Like, they don't deserve our time. They don't deserve our energy, but yet power and voice, right?
Yeah.
And like, there's power in numbers. And so at some point, continuing to educate the world about, yeah, this is the stuff that they do. And they don't stop because it is about power and control. It is not just about, oh, I have this opportunity to get this high that I really like from this disgusting thing that I do, right? It's not that. It's, I like the game. I am more sociopathic than I am opportunistic. And I'm not going to quit because I like the high.
Right.
That's the reality.
It's also an organization, right? So it's mm-hmm. not one offender who is unable to let go or who is, it's an organization of people, and we're watching that play out in real time. It's, you know, the Kearns are suing us over here. We've got a Facebook page over there. We've got a Instagram post over there. There are people who are running around town who are gathering information and presenting it in ways that are skewed for the offenders. Like, how are these people even connected or related, but they are, you know, it's an organization of people working together to abuse and to silence the victim. That is classic behavior. Again,
we're reading the research. We're reading the books. We are educating ourselves about these things. A lot of people listening to us aren't. Okay. Mm-hmm. So either we'll post the information and you can get the book and you can read it yourself. You can read the research. There's videos, there's all the things, or you could take our word for it. Right. Mm-hmm. Or honestly, if you're out there and you're going to try to poke holes in what we're telling you about the research, go read the research. Feel free to try to poke holes in it because it's out there. So the statistics we're citing, like, it's from reputable. We're not talking about like we just pulled something off of like Wikipedia.
Like they do. Sorry.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah. Not like that. We're not doing that.
No, we're not doing that. Okay, so I feel like then we have to move into talking about what does organized abuse look like and how is it different, right? We've talked about this ad nauseum with family-controlled trafficking, and obviously we have already talked so much about that, but we have alluded to the fact, and I don't know how much we've really dived, but honestly, some things I'm like, have we said that? I have no idea.
I
Like,
know. I
we
know.
need to cut that
No, I feel like that too. People are like, oh, is
because.
that in the podcast somewhere? And I'm like,
I don't know.
I
Good
know.
luck.
We know that we have primarily talked about this as family-controlled sex trafficking. That has been primarily the phraseology that we've used, and it's appropriate. It's the right phrase. But the umbrella that exists over family-controlled trafficking is often organized child sexual abuse. And that's really what we have to talk a little bit more about because it's part of why it's so hard to get free.
So, the importance of dates. Again, we've talked a little bit about this with anniversaries and with dates. There are certain traditions in organized abuse. Again, it's not unique to me. It's just what they do. It's like a playbook. We've seen it in the research. We've talked to other victims. For me personally, big holidays, Easter, Christmas, Halloween, my birthday, Mother's Day, Father's Day, those a lot of holidays. Have meaning, really, really sick, twisted meaning. We keep saying like they tried to serve us with this lawsuit on my birthday. That's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence because when they
No.
use your birthday to say you were born for this is the thing that God designed you for was to serve these men and to do this thing, and God hates you because of that, and you're disgusting and dirty, and that's what your birthday represents. That's a tradition, right? They use that, they misuse that. They misuse that date as a way to further abuse, right? Christmas is no different. They use this Advent season to send messages and to further abuse.
And to make sure that the programming sticks, right? That they programmed in all of those things that you said about your birthday. And they want to keep reinforcing that to keep you trapped and to keep you silent. That's why they don't stop.
And that's part of why the traditions is the programming, right? It's like my brain knows to expect that something bad is coming or that it's going to happen, and then they condition it and they make it so that it does happen, right? There's never been a birthday that's gone by that something hasn't happened or something hasn't been left or a threat or something. There just hasn't been one since I've been born that something hasn't happened. This year, they just their only avenue really was a lawsuit. And so that's the avenue they chose this year.
Help people connect to that concept. Like we understand traumaversaries, right? So if you have had a big, awful event, honestly, this is a big thing in the adoption world. Like even kids who don't have a conscious memory of a trauma that happened before they were adopted, their adoptive parents start saying, like, they were removed from their birth family in October, and every year in October that my child starts to get a little cuckoo crazy, and it's a traumaversary. We also understand it in terms of, like, I don't know, more seemingly benign things. Like, you grew up in a family where there was a certain holiday that didn't go very well, or your birthdays, were always really hard, or whatever. You're gonna have a kind of a reaction around that time, and it's just that happened just as a matter of course of having trauma. In what we're talking about here in the organized abuse realm, it was purposely, it is purposely created.
Yeah, and it doesn't, it never isn't. Like, again, it's the whole thing of them never being able to just let go. They will probably never stop, honestly. That's the truth of it. They will probably never stop trying. So, again, it's not lost on us that the first one came on my birthday, second one during Advent, during Christmas season. You know, that's not lost on us. And what they're trying to do is to trip the programming. They're trying to trip the part of my brain that says, this is what I was born for. This is the only thing that I'm supposed to do. And they were right about all the things that they said about me. And I have to just go back. I have to just go back and be hurt. That's what they're hoping is going to get tripped. And
hoping that your hopelessness will be tripped.
Yeah, because for my whole life, it was hopelessness. It was just, there was nowhere else to go. There was, even when I tried to get out, even during my escape attempts, it didn't matter. Ultimately, they were able to isolate me. They were able to take away my support people, and they were able to discredit me and
take away your power and voice.
Yeah, and I continued to be hurt into adulthood. And so that's what they're hoping for. That's the goal, is they're going to trip that programming. They're also really intentional about the way that they do things. They're hoping I'm going to lose my support people again, because it's happened before many, many, many times. It's happened before. Specifically this year with this lawsuit from Sherry Kern, they sued both of us in May, but Sherry Kern is only suing me, even though it's literally the almost exact same law. They copy and pasted the lawsuit. But why? Because they know that I see this as, you know, they sued both of us in May, hoping that Lori would leave, that she would say, this is too hard. I'm going to settle and be out of this, right? And she didn't. And so now they're just suing me because that didn't work. So now we'll just target just you, right? We'll just isolate you and make this just your problem. And Lori doesn't have to stay in it because she's not part of it. So that's the goal there. And again, it's obvious. It's so obvious to us what is happening and the programming and what they're trying to kick off. And yet the world around us doesn't see it because it's so under talked about. It's not something that people see. It's just not. It's so well hidden and it's so underreported.
And they are masterful at doing this in ways that are not obvious to the outside world.
Yeah.
They are masterful. They have been doing it your whole life, and it's not just you. It's other survivors. Read the accounts, people listen to their videos, like pay attention, but they are masterful at making it seem like the victim is crazy.
Yep.
Or lying. And people are just too willing to believe that that's true because they don't want to see.
Because our society leans in that direction for sexual assault victims, right? I mean, look at the Matt Ariza case right now. I'm not entirely up to speed on that specifically. But this poor woman, I mean, she makes this report, whatever, she drops the lawsuit, and the entire world is like, see, she lied. She didn't lie. Are you kidding me? Like, all the evidence that they have. And she should never, ever have had to put that evidence out there for public consumption. But even though she did, she lied because she dropped the lawsuit. So she lied, right? Our society leans into not believing sexual assault survivors, into not protecting their rights, into not protecting their privacy.
Can I say something about the Matt Ariza case? Even if, okay, what we're saying is like they declined to prosecute him criminally because they're saying some version of like, it was consensual, right? Okay. She was 17 years old, drunk at a college party, and a bunch of college football players had sex with someone who was underage and clearly inebriated. But yeah, let's all work to get him back on the football team. Let's give this poor boy who missed his golden opportunity at a football career, let's give him another chance. Because it can't be prosecuted because whatever reasons, because we know how hard it's to prosecute, especially sexual assault. But we're dismissing and ignoring the fact that that's still disgusting.
Yeah.
Like,
that's the other part of it, though, Laura. You say, even though we know how hard it is to prosecute sexual assault, everybody knows that. Everybody hears us say the statistics of, what is it, 1 in 1,000 or something like that? Like, it's stupid numbers for how many sexual assaults take place versus how many are prosecuted.
25 in every 1,000 go to jail.
Are prosecuted. And how many are actually incarcerated? 10?
I think so. Yeah. Some number
like
that. It's a
ridiculously small percentage. So we all know those statistics. Mm-hmm. And yet We lean into this idea of, well, if there wasn't a prosecution, then it must not be true. Make this make sense to me. Like, now I'm raging because, like, how is it that we treat women this way?
You have 975 out of every 1,000 people who are sexually assaulted. Their case never gets prosecuted. But yeah, they're all lying or like what? I mean, it's ridiculousness. It's ridiculous. And we wonder why women, again, sexual assault survivors are not always women. Why sexual assault survivors, we wonder why they don't seek the police. The research shows us that by and large, people who encounter the police as a result of a sexual assault report that they come out of that experience feeling worse, not better.
Yep. All of that being said, what is different for me now? And the reason why they can't win, and the reason why they can continue to do things to me, and they will continue. That's probably never going to end, unfortunately. But the difference is now that I have people. And unfortunately, it took a goddamn podcast to cultivate some of that and to get the safety piece of it, which is still not even, you know, every day I work a safety plan. Every single day I am having to think about where I'm going, who I'm going with, if I'm going to be alone. I have to think
about how am I going to not be alone? Right.
Yep. But the difference is now is that I have people. I have Lori. I have my husband, Patrick, who is aware and who knows and who is protecting. I have my in-laws. I have friends and family. I have a kick-ass attorney. I would not want to be on the other side of him in an argument. Like, he's amazing and a very kick-ass attorney. Many survivors never have that. Many, 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 many survivors never find that. They don't find their support system. And like I said, yeah, you know what? It took a podcast. I would never have crossed paths with Christiana and in my adult world if I had not had a podcast. I would never have probably been able to tell my in-law family as much as I've been able to without a podcast, right? There are people in my world, in our world, that I would not have if we had not done a podcast. But it shouldn't take a podcast. It shouldn't have been that I had to put parts of my story on display for public consumption to be able to get help and to be able to get this group of people, this network of people that I now have that stand with me, in front of me, beside me. So many survivors don't have that, and they shouldn't have to start a podcast to get that. So that is why Mezzo, right? We will always come back to this reality of if not us, then who, right? If we don't help to cultivate that for other survivors, then what are we really doing in life? So,
are passionately pursuing something positive with Mezzo that is proactive and forward thinking and other focused. It allows us to feel like we're not just stymied in the ridiculousness of what these people are trying to do. It feels like there's something bigger and more important happening than safety planning. Not that that, you know what I mean? That's not that that's not important, but it feels endless.
I feel like it's like this whole feeling of, yeah, like we are lighting the world on fire with Mezzo allies. We are training across the country and we are doing amazing things and we're excited about it. And we call this over here ridiculousness because in the scheme of things, it is. And it's also not, because it still hurts and it still sucks and it is draining and it's exhausting. I was talking to someone today about it who called me and asked how I was doing. And I said, I'm so tired. And he was like, yeah, that's what they're hoping for. They're hoping to just exhaust you and you'll just be so exhausted that you'll finally give up. And he's dead on. He's right. That is the goal, is to just exhaust me.
And you sound exhausted today.
I am exhausted today. I'm also sick, yeah. But that's just because I have three kids who sneeze directly into my eyeballs. So, you know.
I love that for you.
Yeah, no worries. Oh my gosh, I have to tell you, this is, we probably cut this, but I told, a friend today, a mutual friend that we both said the phrase to her, one fry short of a happy meal. Have you heard this phrase?
Yeah.
She was like, what did you just say? I was like,
She
you know,
never
like
heard
one
it.
fry short of a happy meal. No. She was like, I've never heard that, but I'm using it every day now.
Before we finish, I just want to make sure that we very clearly say, yes, you are tired. Exhausted. Tired is too small a word. Yes, you are exhausted. And yes, it sucks. And yes, it's sad and frustrating and so many feelings and everyday safety planning, everyday feeling like you can't be a full adult because you can't be alone. You can't run into a store to get milk for your kids. Like, yes to that, all of that every single day. And I don't want to skim past how hard this is, but I also want to make sure that everybody listening understands things can never go back to the way that they were because it is fundamentally changed because you have power and voice, because people are listening, because you have people in your corner who are unwavering. There is no going back to where they can just do whatever the heck they want, whenever the heck they want to. They're still doing stuff, but they're not doing the stuff that they actually want to do. So it is very, very important to just, I don't know, I need everybody to hear that yeah, it's hard, but it is not ever going to be the way that it was before. I know that doesn't always feel true, but
No, it does. I know.
you're still exhausted.
I am.
I
But
know.
I won't be. I will rest and keep going. We keep going.
We keep going.
Right?
Yeah, there's an episode that says so.
As always, thank you so much for listening and for supporting. We are forever grateful that we have a podcast and that we have people who listen to it.
If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, HELP, to 233-733.